just at her plate, and continued to smile. No post-its?
No, no one loves you today.
Studying the empty door facing that held all my square yellow paper correspondence, Vic passed me and went toward her office as I sat on the dispatcher's desk, which always antagonized the dispatcher. Where's Hazard Pretoria? At the mention of our Basque deputy, Ruby looked up over her glasses at me as she reached down and petted Dog, who had settled in under her desk, or as much of him as the furniture would allow.
Out, taking care of the post-its.
I guessed, lost Dog. Dog raised his head to look at me and then registered it as a false call and resettled. Ruby shook her head.
Somebody found a set of engagement rings in the parking lot of the Baptist church, so he went over to pick them up for the lost and found.
I'll notify the paper and get it up on our website. We have a website? She frowned at me. I'm willing to try the computer again if you want. Having tired of my dilettante behavior toward technology, Ruby had gotten me a computer. Sazer Pretoria had assisted in getting it on my desk and up and running, but the complications of operating the thing had thwarted me at every turn, and the entire office had decided it was more trouble teaching me how to use it than it had been worth. Currently, it was downstairs on the community desk, where I sometimes paused in passing to hit the spacebar to see the screensaver photo of my daughter and granddaughter.
I think we'll all pass.
Roger that, I stood. Anything need my attention?
Payroll checks need to be signed, and they're on your desk.
You know, I'm starting to feel like a turnkey around here. Dismissing me, she went back to her mound of papers.
Tell me about it.
Entering my office, I placed the artwork on my guest chair and stood there looking out the western window at the Bighorn Mountains, thinking how easy it would be to just get into the truck and head over to Cody. But realizing it wouldn't be particularly fair to my writing partners or to the Buffalo Bill Museum, which I hadn't contacted yet. Giving in to the inevitable, I sat and began signing as I flipped through the Rolodex Vic had threatened to sell on eBay, finally finding the number of the chief of staff of the venerable McCracken Research Library that lurked in the basement of the sprawling Center of the West.
Mary Robinson.
Hi, Mary. It's Walt Longmire. Adjusting the receiver in my ear, I listened as she smiled over the line.
Well, hello, Walt Longmire.
Mary, do you guys have anything on Cassidy Adams? Custer's last fight and Moonlight on the Mississippi?
That's him.
I'm sure we have some information on him. What exactly are you looking for?
Mostly information on Custer's last fight.
The Budweiser painting.
For lack of a better name, yep.
You know, it burned.
I was hoping that wasn't the case, but that's what I've read. I think I might have an artist study that Cassidy may or may not have done.
Oh, my.
Anyway, I've got the thing and thought I might drive over tomorrow and have you guys take a look at it and see if it's the real deal.
We'd be happy to. I'll just make sure our conservationist is here.
Great. Not quite ready to hang up, I asked. Hey, Mary, let's say for the point of argument that the painting wasn't burned and had been found. What would it be worth? She laughed. You do know the original painting was a triptych, and that the two outer panels are at historical archives in Arizona. What are they of?
Custer as a child, and then the aftermath of his death. They're in pretty rough shape, but worth seeing if you're really interested.
What about the worth of the painting?
The one that burned?
Yep.
You're not kidding?
Nope. There was a pause.
Well,
if it were being auctioned, it would certainly be a price-on-demand sort of thing. That doesn't answer my question.
24, 25.
I swallowed.
Million? Easily.
So if somebody were to buy it at, say, $1 million, it'd be the bargain of the century? There was another pause.
Walt, are you serious about this painting having been found? Because if you are, we here at the Buffalo Bill would be interested.
No, no, I haven't found the painting, but the artist's study we discovered was accompanied by $1 million in $100 bills, and I'm just trying to assemble where all that money could have come from.
If, and it's a big if, that painting were still in existence and was procured for $1 million, then somebody was horribly robbed.
Well, that settles a few things. Do I need to make an appointment, or can I just drop in sometime tomorrow?
I'll be here all day. We've got a syndic tomorrow night.
Anything you need from this side of the mountains?
If you run into any spectacular specimens of historic fine art that have been until lately presumed destroyed, you're number one on my list. Hanging up the phone, I rested my eyes on the cardboard print in the folded cardboard frame and then the smaller, more personal struggle going on in the left lower corner. So much for that theory. Picking up the phone again, I rang the number I knew by heart and waited. After a few rings, he picked up. "It is another beautiful day here at the Red Pony Bar and Grill and continual soiree. Do you have Prince Albert in a can?" "No, we have him in a pouch, but the results are much the same. And before you ask, yes, our refrigerator is running, and no, we are not going to go catch it. You want to come over tomorrow morning and ride in with me, and we'll pick up Vic and head over to Cody?" "Certainly. I'm assuming we are spending the night. Do you still want to stop at the battlefield?" "I do on the way back, along with another short stop in Billings, if you do not mind." "Overnight it is." The line went dead before I could ask what the other stop might be, so I hung up and raised my face to find Santiago's Observatoria standing in the doorway. "So you want to get married?" "I don't think you're my type." He stepped in, handing me the small box. "Too bad, because I've got a hell of a set of rings here." Flipping the thing open, I gazed at the intertwined 24-carat rings, encrusted with multiple diamonds in a large setting flanked on both sides. "Jeez, somebody robbed the ice plant." "I know, right? The Baptists are taking in way too much money these days." Turning the box in my hand, I watched as the light played off the stuff dreams were made of. "Any idea?" "Close to 20,000, I'd say." "Between this and the cool million I found, things are looking up here in the county." He leaned against the wall. "So I don't get to go to Cody?" "Somebody's got to stay here and collect the riches." Handing him the rings, I eased back in my chair. "Get that in the safe before you lose it. Somebody out there is having a heart attack." Looking at the box, he pushed off the wall. "If nobody collects it, can I have it?" "I'm sure Marie would appreciate that, but no." Going out the door, he stopped and then gave me a parting shot. "First you give away our $1 million, and now this. You're not much fun these days." "You're not the first to notice." Ruby's voice sounded from the other room. "Walt, Isaac Bloomfield, line one." Holding a finger up to size of Pretoria, I punched line one and lifted the receiver, holding it to my ear. "What's the word on the autopsy?" "Well, hello to you, too. Heart attack." "You sound disappointed." "No hint of foul play?" "None that we can find other than a syringe mark where he must have had some sort of injection that night. But there's nothing in his medical chart that says he should have had one."
"Nothing in the toxicology?"
"No. We went through Charlie Lee's medications, and he was taking an assortment of drugs that had to do with his heart, but sometimes it's just the mileage."
"Nothing else?"
"No, I'm afraid not."
"Thanks, Doc."
I hung up the phone and looked at my deputy. "Anything else?" "The transport service is going to be here this afternoon to collect the Gibson guy and haul him back to San Jose, where he has a number of priors and a few outstanding warrants."
I'd forgotten about the would-be kidnapper and stood.
"Is he ready to go?"
"No, I'm heading there now." "I'll go with you, just in case you want to get him out."
Passing through the main part of the office under Ruby's careful eye, we started down the steps to the landing and took a left toward the basement and the jail proper. The holding cells upstairs were comfy by comparison, and I slept in one on a regular basis, but very little about Gibson had recommended the man, so we'd incarcerated him in the windowless bowels of the old Carnegie building. Sizer Pretoria was just as glad to be rid of him, having tired of providing docent service for the last two nights, including shower break, when the guilty man had attempted to climb out the bathroom window, only to be thwarted by the bars we'd anchored there after the last individual had escaped into the populace at large wearing only a bathrobe. Walking by the communal table, I hit the space bar and smiled back at my tiny MIA family and thought about calling Katie before following the Basco down the hallway where a completely unclothed Dean Gibson stood in the middle of the cell.
"I'm not going."
Sizer Pretoria glanced at me and then back at the naked man.
"Excuse me? I have no reason to go back there."
"Well, the state of California and Santa Clara County appear to have other opinions about that." I leaned against the bars.
"You mind telling us why you don't have any clothes on, Mr. Gibson?"
"I'm not going to make this easy.
I got a tub of Vaseline from the bathroom and I'm all greased up, so it's going to be a fight.
On closer inspection, he did have a kind of sheen to him.
To make it harder to get hold of you?
You got it.
What, did you see that in a movie or something?
Yeah.
Mr. Gibson, the only thing that's going to do is get you in either a straitjacket or a full harness cufflink and leg irons with a belly chain, which can be very uncomfortable for traveling in a van for 1,000 miles.
He made a face.
A van? I don't even get to fly?
It'll be a van, yep.
Fuck that! I'll fight all of you.
He readjusted, feet apart, and raised his fists into boxing stance.
I was a Golden Gloves champion back in San Jose.
I stared at the man for a good while and then raised my hands.
Well, we'll just wait until the transport boys get here and see how they want to handle it.
You're damn right. He threw a few punches, shadowboxing the air between us.
Cesar Vittorio followed me down the hallway where I stopped to let him pass before he turned back to study me.
That's it? We're not going to secure him before they get here?
Reaching beside him, I closed the heavy metal door to the cells and then continued on before stopping at the base of the steps and jacking the air conditioning to its maximum setting.
Do me a favor and close off all the ducts out in this part of the basement.
He smiled.
Yes, boss.
I hung up with the manager of the IGA, confirming that, yes, the bag that had been used as a liner in the $1 million shoebox was indeed the current version the grocery chain was using. After that, I called Wes over at the bank and confirmed that, yes, the serial numbers were not consecutive and the bills ranged in date from 1952 to a year ago.
No large-sized bills?
Not since 1927.
No silver certificates?
No, and no Confederate money either. I repositioned the phone in my ear.
Anything on the bands?
They're a strange color, unlike any I've ever seen, blank with white borders as opposed to ours, which are white with colored borders.
I thought they were all blank.
No, definitely two-tone, lighter than the ones we use for $1 bills and a 50-bill count. You see, when the Federal Reserve gave up counting bills by hand in the late 70s, the American Bankers Association set a standard for both the value and color of currency bands.
I had no idea.
All bills larger than $1 come in currency straps of 100, and the color allows for quick accounting, even when the bills are stacked, say, in a vault. Striped bands are only used on straps for star notes.
Okay, you got me there. What's a star note?
A replica banknote that replaces a faulty one during regular production to account for the serial listing, but with a notation, usually a 5-point star.
Well, you learn something every day.
I heard some noise out front and assumed the transport contractors were here for Gibson. So you're telling me that every denomination has a color code. What did you call it? Currency strap. Those used to wrap ones come in a number of colors, but fives are red, tens are yellow, 20s are violet, 50s are brown, and 100s, like the ones you have here, are usually mustard colored. But these are white, with white borders. I listened to the silence on the line connecting me to the man across the street.
Yes, and one other thing. They're overlapped by quite a bit, which leads me to believe that they're foreign.
Why?
Most foreign bills are wider than ours, hence longer currency straps.
No way to tell what country?
I've made some inquiries, but at this point, nada.
Anything else?
There was a receipt for the shoes in the bottom of the box, under a flap. They were bought in El Paso, Texas, in 1963 for $9.
Interesting.
I know shoes used to be cheap. Did you get a warrant for the security box, just in case there happens to be one, from Vern?
Not yet, but I think I'll go up and bug him.
He laughed. Good luck with that.
Alone and bereft, I hung up the phone and studied the surface of my desk. The front page of this week's Durant Current tempting me to open it up and read Charlie Lee Stillwater's obituary.
What did you do, Charlie Lee?
Rob a South American bank?
Vic appeared in the doorway.
Hey, the transport guys are here, and there's a lot of banging coming from down in the jail, and every time I ask Sancho about it, he just laughs and says to ask you.
Tell him to go see if Gibson's got his clothes back on yet.
He took his clothes off?
Yep, and then he oiled up like he was competing in a greased pig contest.
Oh, boy!
Standing, I followed her into the main office where two fidgety men in uniforms and bowl caps were standing in front of Ruby's desk.
The older one with the ubiquitous cop mustache stuck out a hand. "Rick Pritchard, Security Prisoner Services." I took the sweaty hand, and he gestured to the other man. "Jim Brewer, second in command." "Nice to meet you. You have your paperwork?" Ruby handed it to me, and I studied the transport for hire forms. "Where are you guys coming from?" The younger one answered, his voice a little strained. "We're on a loop out of Oakland and went as far as Chicago."
"Chicago?"
"Yeah."
"In a van?"
The older one nodded. "But we had stops in Minneapolis, Bismarck, and Rapid City on the way back." I flipped through the papers, holding them and looking into his bloodshot eyes. "That's at least 20 hours of driving."
"Solid. So if you could just sign those papers, we'll get your prisoner loaded and be on our way."
"You've been driving for 20 hours and are planning on driving another 17 once you get my prisoner loaded?" The older one volunteered.
"Hotel rooms are out of pocket, so we'd like to just keep moving."
He pointed at the papers I held. "If you don't mind, how many prisoners do you have on board?"
"8, not including yours."
Handing the forms back to Ruby, I turned toward the two men. "I want to see them." Confused, they both looked at me.
"The prisoners?"
"Yep."
"Look, with all due respect, we don't have time for all this, really."
I faced him squarely and changed my tone. "You're in my county. And without any disrespect, I've asked to see your prisoners. Are you refusing?" I stepped in a little, making a point of looking very closely at their dilated pupils and flushed faces. "Because if you are, the first thing I'm going to do is arrest you and get a blood sample to see what you're on. I'm guessing some kind of amphetamine."
They looked at each other, and the older one stammered, "We've just been drinking a lot of coffee, Sheriff."
"Let me see your prisoners."
They looked at each other again and then turned and started out as I followed, meeting Sergeant Pretoria on the landing as he came up from the jail.
"He's got his clothes back on and appears to have lost some of his fight."
"Good. Follow us."
We continued out the door to where a large van with the utility box sat in the parking lot, the only windows in the cargo area small and up high. Pritchard unlocked the back doors and swung them open to reveal a set of metal cage doors with ventilation holes drilled into them. Leaning forward, I could see that a plexiglass blockade divided the inside, with two women sitting on one row of plastic seats and four men on the other. There was trash on the floor, and the smell was horrible. "When is the last time these prisoners were out of this van?" He stared at me. "When was the last time these prisoners were fed or allowed to use a toilet?" He gestured toward the woman who sat closest, her head hanging down and her leg irons attached to the floor. "We picked her up in Rapid City, so she's only been in here for 4 hours."
"But at least one of these prisoners has been in here for 17?
He didn't seem to have an answer for that.
"Sir!"
I peered into the darkness and could make out a middle-aged man in a hoodie and sweatpants, seated next to last away from me on the men's side.
"The man sitting next to me was supposed to be getting some kind of medication for diabetes, but he hasn't, and he's passed out and soiled himself something awful."
I stepped back. "Get them out."
Pritchard looked at me in disbelief.
"What?"
"Get them out of there right now. We'll put them in our jail till they can be fed and cleaned up, and we'll take the other one over to the hospital to be looked at. You have his medication?"
The younger one, Brewer, nodded.
"Yeah."
He disappeared around the corner, and I motioned for Sergeant Pretoria to follow as I confronted Pritchard.
"Heard of the Jena's Act?"
"Nope."
"You're gonna. It's had a lot of guidelines on what you can and can't do with prisoners in private transport situations."
Sergeant Pretoria, holding a Ziploc bag, arrived with the younger man in tow. He handed it to me.
"This is on the dash."
I felt the warm bag.
"Insulin. You know you're supposed to keep this stuff cold, like in a cooler?"
Brewer looked at me and blinked as I turned to Sancho. "Call the EMTs and get them over here with some fresh insulin, and then get Vic and we'll start loading these people into our cells." Pritchard made the mistake of laying a hand on my arm.
"Look, you can't!"
I looked at the hand, and then at him. "You have a medical emergency on your hands, not to mention the fact that you are in so many violations that it's going to take a legal pad to list all of them. Now, what's going to happen is that you're going to help my staff unload your van, and we're going to see to that man who is unconscious. Then you're going to go get a room in a motel and get some sleep while we feed and bathe your prisoners and get them a night's sleep before you head out tomorrow morning. And that's only if I decide to not charge the two of you with criminal negligence." He stared at me. I glanced at the hand on my arm. Again. Chapter 5.
Did you really threaten to beat him to death with his own arm?
Not a threat, really. Trying to keep my foot out of Lola, the Cheyenne Nation's pristine Baltic Blue 1959 Thunderbird convertible, I eased into Ten Sleep Canyon. Actually, more of a promise. Rolling her arm over her seat, she turned and looked at the bear, shouting to be heard over the rushing wind.
What are you going to do about this?
Henry, awakened from his nap, withdrew his hand from Dog's back and lifted his red Pony Bar and Grill cap, rubbing his eyes and looking at her.
What?
That's about a half dozen people he's threatened to beat the shit out of in the last 4 months.
Has he acted on any of them?
Not yet.
He pulled his cap back over his eyes, his long hair twirling around it as if it had a life of its own.
Then there is nothing to worry about.
She pushed back against the passenger side door, kicked off her flip-flops, and rested her feet on my lap.
I think you got some anxiety-repressed anger here.
Negotiating the switchback in a spot I considered to be the most breathtaking in Wyoming, I glanced at her.
Look who's talking.
Mine's not repressed. I give it free expression.
She turned her head, adjusting her sunglasses, and lodged her fingers into the raven hair.
I like to think of myself as something of an anger performance artist.
The bear snorted from the back seat.
So what happened to the prisoners?
The diabetes patient was revived and stabilized, but will remain here until the next transport. The others were given showers, fed dinner, had a night's sleep, breakfast, and then sent on their way with strict instructions to the attending security officers that they stop in Salt Lake City and Reno with documents of transference to be signed by the sheriffs in both locations, or I'd be filing charges with the company.
You really do not like those services, do you?
When they're run correctly, they're fine. But when they're not, they're a horror. Henry nodded, and I watched in the rearview mirror as he looked off toward the fish hatchery below.
Mind if I ask why we are coming this way to go to Cody?
There's an individual in Ten Sleep who knows this Count von Lehman, who is something of an expert on fine art and antiquities. Vic lowered her sunglasses.
Count von who's it?
Count von Lehman. Barbara Schuster over at the Brinton told me about him, says he's something of an expert on this type of thing, and that I should have him look at the canvas to see what he thinks.
I don't know him, but there's a guy over here in Ten Sleep who does.
Henry leaned forward as we left the canyon and twisted our way into the small town that was lodged at its base on the west slope of the Bighorn Mountains. Ten Sleep is known for a number of things, but mostly for its unusual name that was derived from the belief that it was 10 days' travel from a number of destinations, and it is supposedly 10 days' travel from either Fort Laramie to the southeast, the Yellowstone to the west, Old Sioux Camp on the site of what is now Casper to the east, or from north to a spot on the Clark's Fork River that is now Bridger, Montana. Whichever you choose, they are all 10 days' travel, or 10 sleeps. Hence, one of the best western titles this side of Meeteetse, 10 Sleep. A rock-climbing mecca, the town is a curious place, part cowboy, part art and craft, and all bohemian. With only one gas station, a couple of motels, and the rodeo grounds anchoring the west edge of the village, it was easy to miss if you blinked, which we did as I edged toward the red rock cliffs just outside the small town.
We aren't stopping?
Ahead, just a little.
Making a right at the sign that read Ten Sleep Brewing Company Tap Room, I smiled as Vic sat up and announced,
I just want to go on record that in my experience, this is the best investigation in which we've ever been involved.
Pulling up beside an oversized tour bus, I parked the Thunderbird and took the keys from the switch, tossing them to the owner in the cavernous back seat. You coming in?
No, I spend enough time in a drinking establishment.
Putting his cap back over his face, he mumbled,
I will dog sit,
and laid his arm on the beast to settle him from being overly interested in the chickens that appeared in the side yard. Vic climbed out on the other side, and we made our way up the gravel path to the large building.
It looks like a barn.
I think that's how it started out.
You sure somebody's here?
The guy I'm looking for is always here. Swinging the door open, I allowed her to go first and watched as she walked past the large vats of beer fermenting in the front room to continue toward the bar. Moving into the room, I took a left and walked between the sparkling stainless steel containers of the mill, mash tun, kettle fermenter filter, and finally the serving tank, to where a pair of legs were sticking out, accompanied by metallic sounds of tinking and banging. "That's an awful lot of beer to try to shotgun," he laughed, recognizing my voice. "What are you doing on this side of the mountain?" "Oh, on our way west, and thought I'd stop by. I'm looking for somebody." More tinks emanated from under the giant container. But after a moment his head kicked sideways, and I could see the bright blue eyes under the grungy bill of a ball cap. "Uh-oh." "No, nothing like that. Have you ever heard of a Count Philipp von Lehmann?" He laughed. "He's part owner of the brewery, if you count his bar tab." "Know where he lives?" "Sure. He used to live out 434 toward the Red Rufflet Ranch, but I heard he moved to Story, over on your side of the mountain. He do something wrong?" "No, I have a piece of art I need to have looked at, and I thought he might be able to save me a trip to Cody." "If you can catch him. From what I understand, people fly him in and out on their private jets over in Sheridan." "To do what?" He shook his head. "Couldn't say. Hey, give me 2 minutes and I'll be out from under here. Meet you in the bar. Sounds good." Vic was behind the counter, pulling a handle and filling a glass as I entered. "Starting early? Sun's over the yardarm somewhere." She plucked another mug from the bar back. "What's your pleasure?" "A small speed goat." She looked through the handles, finally settling on one, and expertly filled